Welcome to the Prancing Horse Podcast. I'm glad you can join us to learn about the history, news, and culture of the world-famous Ferrari. I'm your host, AJ, and I'm so grateful to continue our Prancing Horse Podcast journey with this fourth history episode. My goal is to share the Prancing Horse culture with not only current, but also future generations to come. This series is going to keep you posted on all that's new in the Ferrari world, from cars to racing and events. Anyone can Google Ferrari, but I wanted to be able to provide you with an insider's perspective. I have been working in the service department of a Ferrari dealership for the last 10 years. So buckle up and let's talk history. Rolling into 1975, at the Paris Motor Show, the 308 GTB would be released, replacing the Dino 246 GT. Using completely new styling and a brand new V8 engine, it would use four Weber 40 DCNF carbs, although the US and European versions would see some differences. The European version using a dry sump oiling system and making a little bit more power, while the US version used a wet sump system and less power due to emissions devices. The first 2 years of the car are known as Vetro Resina cars, since they were made of fiberglass reinforced plastic. This allowed a low weight of the car at only 2,315 pounds. In 1977, they would actually move to steel bodies, adding 331 pounds to the weight figure. This car was made iconic by the hit TV show Magnum PI, with its famous Robin 1 license plate, although this would be the GTS that would debut in 1977. 1975 also brought us the Dino 208 GT4. Released at the Geneva Motor Show, this was an almost identical copy of the 308 GT4, but visually used a smaller displacement 2-liter engine. This was designed for the Italian market because at the time, there was a higher VAT, more than double, for cars with engines larger than 2 liters. This new engine would be the smallest production V8 in history for a road car. Using smaller Weber 34 DCNF carbs, smaller tires, and a lower final drive ratio were some of the mechanical changes that they had to make. Visually, the lack of fog lights and the chrome trim would set it apart from the 308 GT4. Both the 308 and the 208 would wear the Dino name until May 1976, when they finally got the official Ferrari branding, both on the front, the wheels, and the steering wheel. Leading out of the very successful 1975 F1 season and into the 1976 season, the tall airboxes they were using had been banned. This meant that Ferrari could use the previous car for the first three races of the 1976 season, but would have to show up with a new car soon. Enter the 312 T2. To comply with the new aerodynamic rules, the big tall airboxes were removed and the new NACA-shaped ducts were added instead. With a 42mm longer wheelbase, new DeDion rear suspension setup that would later be abandoned for a more conventional application. This setup would prove to be fast, with Niki Lauda leaving the Drivers' Championship having won three races that year already. Unfortunately, in the 1976 German Grand Prix at Nürburgring, Niki would have a suspected rear suspension failure. Now, typically, a single crash or failure in a car's history would not be something that would break us out into a side talk, but this one holds a lot of weight in the history of Formula One. Niki Lauda was sitting comfortable in the lead for the Drivers' Championship coming into the German Grand Prix. It was also decided that this would be the last F1 race to be held at the Nürburgring using the Nordschleife section of the track. One of the issues being, the rescue helicopter was parked on the farthest side of the track. The estimated response time for the helicopter would be almost 7 minutes in certain sections of the track. Along with its very long 14.2-mile surface, it wasn't good for TV either, since most of it honestly couldn't be seen. It would be many of these issues that we would see during Niki's accident here. On lap 2, while coming to the Bergwerk right-hand curve, the car suddenly snapped to the right and spun through some fencing into a dirt embankment, and then spun back onto the track while on fire. The car behind him, piloted by Guy Edwards, was able to narrowly avoid him. But Brett Lunger would hit Lauda's Ferrari and Harold Ertl hitting the back of Lunger. This being mainly because of the extremely narrow track at this point, which was probably a blessing for Lauda. All three drivers would get out of their cars to help him. It took the helicopter an estimated 6 minutes to get to Lauda, and had he not had the help of his fellow racers, he likely would have died. He was flown to a trauma clinic where he would fight for his life for the next 4 days. He would be back in his car in just 6 weeks. He would lose the driver's championship that year by just 1 point to his rival James Hunt. However, Ferrari would win the constructors' championship that year, and Niki Lauda's legacy forever written in F1 history. During that 1976 season, the BB512 was released. This was a replacement for the 365 BB. Now with its larger 5-liter 180-degree V12, the car made slightly less horsepower than its predecessor, but at a lower RPM as well. It also made more torque with its larger displacement. This allowed the car to have better power delivery and made it easier to drive. The addition of a front chin spoiler made the car more aerodynamically happy at high speeds. This stopped the nose from lifting so much like it did on the 365 BB. They also added a dual plate clutch to handle the extra torque and a dry sump lubrication system to prevent oil starvation in hard cornering. With the addition of also 1.5-inch wider wheels and NACA ducts added behind the doors to help cool the exhaust system and the rear brakes. New twin instead of triple tail lights mounted in a slat style rear grille instead of mesh were also added, as well as more vents to the rear deck lid to increase cooling. With 929 produced, this is an increase over the 365 as well. Still, none of these would be sold into the US. They were all imported through a secondary company just as before, making all US cars what they refer to as gray market. Overall, the car was made better. Even though there wasn't an increase in performance, the bigger engine did make the car easier to drive and easier to meet stringent pollution and noise regulation without losing performance. The same year, we also saw an update to the 365 GT4 2+2, with the introduction of the Ferrari 400. Increased to a 4.8-liter V12 and now being offered with a 3-speed automatic transmission, the first Ferrari to ever offer an automatic, or you could get it with its normal 5-speed. The designations being 400 automatic or 400 GT respectively. Also using 5 wheel bolts instead of knockoffs and twin tail lights as well instead of triple, an updated interior and added front spoiler were all changes that were made. With F1 kicking off their 1977 season, we also saw a new car. The 312 T2 was updated to what is known as the 312 T2B or the B specification. The first few races saw the new car that didn't look much different than the year before, with the exception of some Fiat branding added for the first time. However, Lauda was pretty unhappy with the performance in the first two races, and between the Brazilian and South African Grand Prix, the team would work tirelessly to develop the car further. A new rear wing and revised suspension and bodywork would lead Lauda to a win in the South African Grand Prix, even after taking heavy damage from the fatal accident of Tom Price. They would build 3 new cars and continue its development through the season. The car struggled on its Goodyear tires as they had been modified for Lotus's heavy downforce. The car would struggle to build heat in the tires and the team constantly changing wing configurations. In one such instance, Lauda deemed the car undrivable and retired at the Swedish Grand Prix. Despite its flaws, the car was very reliable and pushed Lauda to another driver's championship and a 3rd in a row constructors' championship for Ferrari. Lauda would walk away from the team after he won the championship at Watkins Glen. His replacement, Gilles Villeneuve, would find the car too neutral in its handling for his style and struggled to make the car work. At the last race of the season, Gilles Villeneuve would have some brake fade, colliding with the car of Peterson and flipping the 312 over the Armco barrier and instantly killing a spectator and a marshal who were standing in a restricted area. Rolling into the 1978 season, the Scuderia team would release the 312 T3 at the 3rd race. Using the same basic engine design since 1970, but constantly tweaking and tuning this version, it made around 515 horsepower. The chassis was completely revamped with a new monocoque, new suspension, and new flatter bodywork. This would all be used in conjunction with its new Michelin Racing slicks. However, the Lotus 79 ground effect cars would dominate this year, leaving the Scuderia to race for second most of the time. They would take a few wins through the season, and Joel would take his first win at the last race, leaving the Prancing Horse with a second-place Constructors' Championship trophy. Now, you may have noticed we have a gap where we didn't have any new cars released, and you may be wondering why. Well, this is because of what I call the 1970-something slump. In 1975, Road and Track asked on their March cover, "Will exotic cars survive?" This was due to a multitude of reasons, I believe. One of them being the 1973 energy crisis that had all automotive manufacturers, but especially niche ones, building expensive cars with little engines and almost no power. Lamborghini, Aston Martin, and Maserati would all go bankrupt around this time. From 1972 to 1975, Ferrari sales went from 1,800 cars to just 1,300, a 28% reduction. I believe that this move of a lack of new models was completely tactical. They were focusing on selling and producing as many cars as they could for a period of time to keep up without retooling and too much redesign. In my opinion, this likely kept them alive. And in 1979, they would surpass the 2,000 unit sold mark for the first time in their history, and with it, mostly thanks to the 308 GTB and GTS sales. We would see an update to the 400 in late 1979 with the 400i. This would update the car with Bosch K-Jetronic mechanical fuel injection and a new badge. That was pretty much it. Power was slightly reduced, but emissions were overall improved to comply with US standards. We also had an amazing year of F1, with a new ground effect car and a new lead driver. The 312 T4 would hit the grid, and so would Jody Scheckter. Jody and Gilles would work great together this season, sharing all of their data with each other and taking a 1-2 finish in the car's debut race at the South African Grand Prix. The car wasn't just fast, it was reliable, with only one retirement due to mechanical issues in the whole season. Each driver won 3 races for the season, and Scheckter would win the Drivers' Championship, and Gilles would take second, and Ferrari taking the Constructors' title for the 4th time in just 5 seasons. Scheckter was gifted his 312 T4 from Enzo, and he still owns it. It's actually going up for sale at the RM Sotheby's auction in May 2024. In 2010, he ran the car at the Bahrain Grand Prix to celebrate the 60th anniversary of Formula One. This brings us to 1980, where we have an update for the 308 as well. It too would get the Bosch K-Jetronic fuel injection and some minor interior updates. And just as the other cars, it would be down on power, but more emissions friendly. Paired with a new Marelli Digiplex ignition system, this would use a coil, distributor, and module for each bank of the engine. It also came with slightly different wheels. But the 308 would also get a little brother, the 208. This 208 would replace the 208 GT4 2+2 in the lineup and use the same 2-liter engine. This was mainly designed for the Italian market as the VAT was still almost double for cars with engines over 2 liters. Just 300 208s would ever be produced. Ferrari also added a replacement for the 308 GT4. This would be known as the Mondial 8, revealed at the 1980 Geneva Auto Salon and offered in either a coupe or cabriolet. This would be a 2+2 car with a 3-liter fuel-injected V8 borrowed from the 308 GTBI. Since this would wear the Ferrari badge right from the beginning, unlike the 308 GT4, the styling was done by Pininfarina instead of Bertone. 1980 was also an interesting year for F1. Coming off a booming season the year before, all eyes, I'm sure, were on the new 312 T5. But hope quickly faded as the wide boxer engine they had been using could not keep up aerodynamically with the progress made by other teams. As other teams progressed through the season, Ferrari would not, with Scheckter even failing to qualify in Canada. The Scuderia team would fail to win a single race that year, and Scheckter would retire at the end of the season, with the team taking 10th in the Constructors' Championship. This would take us to the turbocharging era in F1, with an entirely new car in the 1981 season. Debuted at the second day of testing for the Italian Grand Prix, the car would use an almost identical chassis as the 312 platform, but with a new 1.5-liter V6 engine fitted with 2 triple K turbochargers. The car would produce around 600 horsepower in qualifying mode and around 550 for race pace. This car would be called the 126CK. Due to the smaller engine design, the car was aerodynamically better than its predecessor, but still not quite up to par with the other teams on the grid. Wrecks and chassis problems plagued the team this year, and they would end up fifth in the Constructors' Championship. The driver that replaced Scheckter would be Didier Pironi. Pironi and Jules would never be the team that Scheckter and Jules were. By the end of the 1981 season, they would not speak to each other due to Pironi ignoring team orders and taking a win from Jules at the race in Imola. 1981 also saw the introduction of fuel injection to the 512BB, which would now be known as the 512BBI. This would use the Bosch K-Jetronic fuel injection as well as the new Marelli Dinoplex electronic ignition system. This would come with some minor exterior updates as well, such as red lights added down by the tailpipes, the fog lights would be more exposed with a trimmed up grille in the front, and new front bumper marker lights. 1982 would be a tragic but successful year for the Scuderia team. Starting out the year strong with a revised chassis using composite materials reinforced with carbon fiber, a new genuine monocoque chassis using honeycomb aluminum panels, the car was a lot closer to its British competitors now. Handling was vastly improved, as was aerodynamics. The car would put down some solid lap times in testing. However, at its debut race in South Africa, both cars would retire, and again 2.5 months later at the Long Beach Grand Prix. Tragedy would strike, however, when in practice for the Belgium Grand Prix, Jules Villeneuve would crash, ending his life. As Jules was coming over the rise of the first chicane, he would see the car of Jochen Mass moving at a much slower pace ahead of him. In anticipation to go around him, he moved to the right. Unfortunately, so did Mass. Jules would strike the back of his car and launch into the air. The car would then nosedive and break apart as it hit the ground. Jules, still strapped to his seat but without his helmet, would be thrown across the track and into the catch fencing. Other drivers rushed to try to help, but it was too late. He was already blue from lack of oxygen. He would die just a few hours later at the hospital. He was said to have had a fatal neck fracture. Ferrari would not fill his spot for the next three races, fielding only one car with Pironi as the lead driver. His spot would eventually be filled by Patrick Tambay, who would overall have a pretty good season. However, in Germany, Pironi would almost die in a very similar fashion as Jules, and would be out for the rest of the season. Ferrari again would not field a second car for two races until Mario Andretti took his seat for the remainder of the season. Overall, Ferrari would win the Constructors' Championship, but not without a tremendous amount of tragedy and drama. It was said by many people in the factory and on the race team that Enzo admired Jules Villeneuve very much, even though they hardly shared a language. Without a doubt, Enzo shed a tear the day the world lost Jules. Thank you so much for joining us for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss any of our new content. Also, make sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and PrancingHorsePodcast.com. And as always, Forza Ferrari.